Chapter 6, The Disempowered Consumer. In March 2015, Starbucks initiated a campaign to generate conversation about race relations in America. As part of that effort, baristas were instructed to write #RaceTogether on coffee cups and to instigate race-related conversations with customers while preparing cappuccinos and blueberry scones. The negative reaction was palpable. Tweets included, "I don't have time to explain 400 years of oppression to you and still make my train," and "Y'all realize there are no colored hands in the press photos, right?" at Starbucks #RaceTogether. And would #Starbucks lower their prices in order to offset the emotional cost of discussing #RaceTogether with a clueless barista? In fact, the comments reached such vitriol that a Starbucks executive had to suspend his Twitter account. Within days, the campaign was eliminated. A different Twitter strategy, in which celebrities or brands invite consumers to ask any question they want, has also proven to be less than successful. In one November 2014 example, talk show host Mehmet Oz, Dr. Oz, asked people to tweet their biggest question for me with the #OzsInbox. In June of the same year, Oz had been called in front of the United States Senate to respond to consumer protection concerns as it related to health claims he made on his show, particularly recommendations for weight loss. The subsequent #OzsInbox campaign was likely intended as a means to bolster the doctor's reputation in light of these very public quackery allegations, as well as to provide an inexpensive means of generating show ideas through viewer input. Questions about serious health concerns began to fill Dr. Oz's inbox, but there was also a flurry of tweets like, "Can you go an entire show without saying the words miracle, toxin, and belly fat?" And, "I accidentally dropped my sonic crystals in the dirt. Are they dishwasher safe?" As well as some from physicians asking, "Why have you not been censured or fired from @ColumbiaSurgery for conduct unbecoming a physician, scientist, and gentleman? And how do I get my patients to stop believing your bull?" Oz is not alone. McDonald's had similar results when they asked people to share their #McD stories. People shared stories of fingernails in their food, getting food poisoning, and preferring to eat feces. Bill Cosby's meme generator did not produce the positive spin the actor-slash-accused rapist was looking for. And #MyNYPD generated pictures of police brutality, rather than the hoped-for smiling faces of community members hugging New York City cops. Events like these lead consumers, that is, us, to believe that we have some level of control over corporate and municipal interests. Companies create a flat-footed or insensitive social media campaign. We post to social media en masse to take them to task, and the campaign gets shut down or taken over. Conclusion: consumers have power. But do we? Let's say an airline leaves you stranded on a tarmac for 5 hours. In the past, the best you could do was write a letter to the CEO or make a phone call to customer service and hope that someone would respond to your complaint. These individual complaints were simple for the company to ignore. It was done in isolation. No one else knew you were dissatisfied, except perhaps a few close friends. And companies rarely responded unless a critical mass of consumers made the same complaint. One might organize a letter-writing campaign or a product boycott, but such efforts take time and considerable coordination. Social media changed this. Feedback is instantaneous and has the potential to become widespread, given a large enough number of followers or friends who willingly pass the message along to others. But so what? Negative consumer conversations rarely have a long-term effect on brands. A month after the Starbucks campaign, the only tweet still listed under the #RaceTogether hashtag stated that the campaign continued, with a link to a CNN puff piece claiming that Starbucks was a better company for having gotten involved in race relations. The only negative comment was, You think you're going against the hashtag RaceTogether campaign? Posting your dislike about it on social media helps spread the word about it. The campaign had no negative effect on sales, and the company overall has sustained increased revenue and profit. As for Mehmet Oz, he is still on staff at a prestigious hospital, and his show started its seventh season in fall 2015. Given our inability to effect significant change, such as getting Bill Cosby arrested or removing Dr. Oz from the airwaves, why do we keep on posting and tweeting? The answer is simple. For a brief time, we could use social media to make a difference, but not anymore, not in the consumer marketplace. Unfortunately, that reality doesn't seem to have caught up with us yet. From Brand Hijack to Brand Hijack 2.0. From around 2000 and through early 2010s, rapidly developing technology allowed companies to include consumer-generated content, or CGC, in their web presences. With that, consumers were able to influence companies in a way they never had before. We were able to give immediate feedback to marketers, first through blogs and then through an array of social media, and much of that feedback was not positive. Greenpeace hijacked Nestle's Facebook page in opposition to the company deforesting Indonesia for palm oil. Mommy bloggers were able to get Motrin to pull an online ad suggesting that baby slings lead to neck and back pain, which the bloggers viewed as bashing baby wearing. Domino's Pizza employees made a disparaging and rather disgusting video highlighting bad conditions at their store and posted it on YouTube. There were early promotions using CGC, but like today's Twitter campaigns, these did not always work as the company intended. Take, for example, a General Motors Chevy Tahoe campaign that ran in 2006. The company invited people to build their own ad and provided online tools and beautiful footage of their SUVs. Environmentalists took GM up on the offer and used the technology to create commercials that condemned not only Tahoes, but also SUVs generally, for being utterly unsustainable. In light of these events and others like them, and since there seemed to be no effective way to prevent us from commenting negatively on brands, or at least no effective way had been developed yet, marketing consultants recommended that companies begin to actively integrate consumers into the process of creating brand messages. These consultants widely talked and wrote about the empowered consumer and how the consumer is in control when it came to brand creation. Engaging consumers in the marketing process came to be known broadly as participatory marketing. It was also called co-creation, vigilante marketing, open source branding, and creative consumers, among others. None of these gained wide usage, either in academia or in corporate America. The term that did catch on was brand hijack, a phrase coined by Alex Wipperfirth in his 2005 book of the same name. The author delineates two ways in which consumers affect the meaning of brands. Serendipitous hijack is the act of consumers seizing control of a brand's ideology, use, and persona. It is most often practiced by brand fanatics within subcultures and is largely unanticipated by, and independent of, the brand's marketing department. The author includes Napster, Doc Martin Boots, and Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer among the brands whose meanings have been defined by the market rather than by the marketers. What is important to note here is that while the brand's message was taken over, there was nothing negative about this takeover, and in all three cases, the brands were revitalized. Alternatively, Wipperfirth describes a co-created hijack as the act of inviting subcultures to co-create a brand's ideology, use, and persona, and pave the road for adoption by the mainstream, which is the sort of participatory marketing that consultants were recommending at the time. In the first case, consumers overtake the brand message. In the second, the brand invites in a small group to do the same, both with positive outcomes. Given this, brand hijack is a misnomer, and more so today than a decade ago. First, it doesn't matter whether consumers manipulate brand communications on their own or we are asked to participate. The process as defined is more like a pep rally than a hostage taking. Second, the term gives the illusion that consumers have control, when this is simply no longer the case, at least not in the vast majority of marketing interactions, and not as it relates to fundamental tenets of a brand. Finally, the term is too limited. Participatory marketing can occur in a variety of ways. Overtaking a brand is certainly one of them, though this very rarely happens. More often, interactions are stage-managed to ensure utterly positive results. Marketers have become adept at manipulating consumer communications, particularly by limiting the framework within which we can talk back. We saw this in Chapter 2 when looking at consumer-generated advertising, or CGA, specifically the Doritos annual Super Bowl campaign. Unlike with the Chevy Tahoe, these CGC commercials are screened, some might say censored, so as to curtail negative consumer commentary. Understanding how to harness the message has made asking consumers to create commercials a popular strategy with a growing number of companies, including Nike, Unilever, and Google, among others. A twist on this idea is to ask consumers to create the product itself. Frito-Lay ran a contest to come up with a new potato chip flavor, and the winner got to share in the profits of the product. Media companies now conceive films and other video content, assuming that users will appropriate it. With Universal's animated film Despicable Me, the Minion characters were developed simplistically. The company made the creative assets available to online users, and thus a large number of site visitors used those assets to make their own content, which ultimately helped to sell the film and ancillary products. A better definition for brand hijacking, though a more appropriate word might be borrowing, would be the hostile takeover of a brand message by an individual or community unrelated to the brand. Note here that it is a takeover of the brand message and not a wholesale takeover of the brand itself. Such hijackings do still occur, but when they do, they tend not to have the same impact that they used to. The usurped communiques tend to be short-term and of limited consequence for the brand. Coca-Cola's obesity campaign provides an example of how this manifests in the current media environment. On January 15, 2013, Coca-Cola launched an anti-obesity project. The cornerstone of this effort was a 2-minute commercial which aired on cable TV and online, and in which the company extolled the litany of initiatives they were implementing in order to help Americans lose weight while retaining Coke products as part of their diet. The short film begins with nostalgic footage of a typical 1950s American soda fountain. It then shows people smiling, eating salads, and recycling plastic bottles. The video shows a plethora of Coke products with large, bright red arrows moving in a downward direction to represent the reduction in calories of many of the brand's products. This is followed by scenes of overweight children exercising, a montage of culturally diverse and smiling people, and a final call to action telling viewers to go to coke.com/comingtogether. The voiceover of the commercial says, in part, "For over 125 years, we've been bringing people together. Today, we'd like people to come together on something that concerns all of us, obesity. The long-term health of our families and the country is at stake. Across our portfolio of more than 650 beverages, we now offer over 180 low and no-calorie choices, and we've created smaller, portion-controlled sizes for our most popular drinks." 2 days later, a video called "The Honest Coca-Cola Obesity Commercial" appeared on YouTube. Using the same footage as the original, producers changed the voiceover. The text begins in the same way as the original, but it is altered to highlight the hypocrisy of a company that produces a sugar-laden beverage claiming to care about the country's health. It states, "These diet beverages still pose serious health risks even though we've reduced the calories per serving. These beverages can still cause kidney problems, obesity, metabolic syndrome, cell damage, and rotting teeth, which leaves 470 beverages which have extremely high unhealthy levels of calories. Consuming large amounts of rapidly digested sugar and high fructose corn syrup can lead to inflammation and insulin resistance, both of which may increase your risk of stroke, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and cancer. All calories are not the same, and the calories in Coca-Cola products have no nutritional value. If you drink Coke, you'll get fatter and fatter. The solution is simple, and it's right in front of your eyes. Don't drink Coke. It's killing you and your family. Coca-Cola, we're partially responsible for America's obesity problem. Coca-Cola's response? Quietly remove all traces of its anti-obesity efforts. The website no longer exists, and even links to healthier living initiatives are dead ends. Other than the honest ad still living on YouTube, it is as if the campaign never happened. Moreover, Coca-Cola sales are up. In addition to disappearing the offending campaign, they overwhelmed the system with the new positive message, your name on a soda can, a la the Mormons. This softer form of brand hijack represents a shift from criticizing a corporation's brand based on how the corporation runs its business, that is, using palm oil or producing environmentally irresponsible vehicles, to primarily criticizing the corporation's messages. Coca-Cola was attacked for trying to own anti-obesity, and Starbucks for thinking it should have a say in race relations. Both were ridiculous concepts, and people rightly criticized the corporations. But neither was an example of the old brand hijack, characterized by sustained effort and long-term impact. In neither the Coca-Cola nor Starbucks case was a brand fundamentally changed or sales affected. Current brand hijacks have become a watered-down version of their predecessors, and by and large, they have been replaced by brand evangelism. Not consumer empowerment, brand evangelism. While the marketing landscape has changed, the discourse around consumer empowerment continues unabated. Admittedly, some clear-thinking marketers and consultants saw as early as 2011 that consumers controlled nothing. Others, however, continue to perpetuate the myth of consumer empowerment. Bob Jeffrey, CEO of advertising agency J. Walter Thompson, has said, "It is about the power of consumers to choose their own destiny, define their world, their media, their interactions with the world, and their ability to control communications. They are now the critic and the creative, marketer and advertiser, creator and consumer, all rolled into one." Lego claims, "We own the logo, but our consumers own the brand." And articles in Advertising Age still make ridiculous claims like, "If you want to talk to this group of consumers, millennials, you cannot control them. If you want to stay in touch with them, let them express themselves." And, "The consumer is in control." Remember that rallying cry from the first decade of the century? The advertising industry goes through so many fads so rapidly, you'll be forgiven for forgetting. As it turns out, consumers are still in control, perhaps even more so. We also see this rhetoric in commentary about consumers/bloggers and their ability to set trends, such as off-the-shoulder styles and helping to revitalize Birkenstocks. However, while these bloggers might help set trends, the vast majority of them are living on a shoestring while they lick the boots of the Bethanys and Beyoncés. Whether blogger or social media maven, consumers do not control brands now any more than they did prior to interactive media. Do brands respond to us more on Twitter? Yes. Are marketers listening in on our conversations about their products? Yes. But they are doing that so they can manage the conversation, not to let us do the talking. The reason a company will respond within 24 hours or less is not simply to provide service, but also to manage the communication. True, we may affect individual campaigns or some small part of the brand messaging, as we did with Starbucks and race relations, but the underlying system is left untouched. Rather, as we saw in earlier chapters, we are being used to spread marketing messages. Our ability to continually communicate about brands has been framed by the industry as consumer empowerment. It is not. It is brand evangelism, also known as word-of-mouth marketing, which we now all know is integral to the new sharing paradigm. Brand evangelism is the positive promotion and selling of a product or service by an individual or community unrelated to the brand. This is the most extreme, most passionate form of sharing. Consumers may forward a video produced by a company or retweet a picture or write a review, but they are also investing significant time and energy to produce content for a product or brand. These are the super fans who become brand influencers, although unlike some of the influencers discussed earlier, they do not get paid. Their goal in creating content and sharing it endlessly is to spread the good word, much in the same way that a religious evangelist would spread the good news. We are becoming brand evangelists, either through our own passion for the brand, or, more typically, because the brand has assisted us in evangelizing it. We looked at two examples of organic brand evangelism in Chapter 2 when we talked about word-of-mouth marketing, specifically in relationship to consumer-generated content. There, we discussed Nutella, a brand with passionate followers who created the World Nutella Day, and Chipotle customers who created and maintained the www.chipotlefan.com website. Entertainment properties, including movies, TV shows, and sports teams, also elicit committed brand evangelists. Star Trek fans, known as Trekkies, and Star Wars fans are excellent examples. The lovers of Harry Potter are incredibly passionate. While J.K. Rowling wrote the books, fans have created a wealth of content around the English wizard that has nothing to do with the original texts. Potter Pals, a series of videos created with puppets representing characters from Harry Potter. College Quidditch leagues, real-world competitions based on the game in the books. And James Potter, a sequel to the series written by a fan, are just a few illustrations of this. These are just some of the rare, true examples of unadulterated brand evangelism. But just as wholesale brand hijacks are outliers, the same is true for brand evangelism. What passes for evangelism is, in truth, word of mouth that a marketer is manipulating in order to frame us as passionate advocates for the brand and as empowered consumers. Beyond paying influencers to tell us about products and services, black ops evangelizing? Marketers facilitate brand evangelism through what are known as brand communities. A brand community is defined as a specialized, non-geographically bound community based on a structured set of social relations among admirers of a brand. In other words, people create rituals and practices around a consumer brand that aid in enforcing and sustaining connections among the members of the community. What makes these communities so effective are the relationships generated among the participants. Deciding not to use a brand is easy. Deciding to walk away from a group of people that you have become friendly with and committed significant time to is more difficult. This is why marketers and Mark Zuckerberg are gung-ho on creating communities. These communities typically exist online, though members may also meet in the real world. Brand community interactions may be instigated by a passionate group of fans, Nutella, but more typically are enabled by brand marketers, such as when Jeep holds its Jeep Jamboree weekends to bring families together in order to teach them how to drive off-road. Apple and Harley-Davidson's brand communities have such obsessive followers that they have been called brand cults. Brand communities with engaged followers exist across product categories. Particularly passionate are car lovers. Tesla owners are crazy about the brand, and BMW lovers have their driving experience. Mobile apps also generate considerable consumer affinity. People love to share apps that make their lives better, easier, or more efficient. This is what propelled the meteoric rise of Uber. Finding a car quickly, knowing how long it would take to show up, and not having to deal with cash or credit at the end of the ride, makes for a more pleasant traveling experience. HBO Go has serious fans, as does Netflix, and for younger users, Snapchat. In each of these cases, though, a marketer helped seal the deal. In the case of the car companies, by holding events and facilitating brand communities. In the case of the app companies, by using early adopters to influence sharing. One company that stuck out as generating considerable enthusiasm is Lululemon, a manufacturer of yoga apparel for women. For some, such as the bloggers who maintain sites like Lululemon Addict, luluaddict.com, and Lulumum, lulumon-blogger.com, which started in 2008 and 2009 respectively, and both of which remain active, the company inspires true brand evangelism. But what Lululemon did and does to foster consumer connections isn't as hands-off as it first appears. Lululemon has been committed to consumer engagement, and its employees are adept at utilizing social media. They maintained a website forum called The Whiteboard, where they ran polls and where company employees gently responded to customer complaints. Here is the empowerment message from the site. "Here at Lululemon Athletica, we are all about collaboration, ideation, and creativity. Your insights and ideas shape our future, and this online community allows us to engage in two-way conversations in order to co-create." But the whiteboard was more sounding board than influencer, sort of like when you talk to someone at an 800 number and they read back to you from a script. And today it lies dormant. Beyond that site, the company has fitness ambassadors, local yoga or CrossFit teachers who wear the company's clothes while they work and endorse the brand to their students, an up-close and personal version of Black Ops marketing. As for social media, the company is active on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, all of which it uses to promote its products, but which it also uses to provide inspiration about running, meditating, and yoga. A recent Facebook post said, "Most of the time we spend looking outside of ourselves for answers. Meditation allows us to access the wisdom that is already there. Practicing silence helps us to listen to our inner voice. Give it a try." Then there is a link that sends you to the company's podcast series on SoundCloud, which displays a large Lululemon logo and asks you to create an account. This is manipulation through spirituality, repackaged to sell high-end yoga wear. There is simply no situation under which spiritual manipulation is acceptable, and yet Lululemon uses the tactic because it creates, well, evangelists. It is sad to say that they are not alone. Soul Cycle, a company that runs very high-end exercise spinning classes, uses a similar strategy. They have a mantra on their wall, and candles burn during workout sessions. Perhaps not surprisingly, the brand is routinely referred to as a cult. Socially conscious brands tap into our passions rather than our spiritual belief systems to help drive evangelism. The clothing brand Patagonia comes to mind. Patagonia has long been known for its commitment to outdoor living and the environment. As a company with a long-standing vision to do no harm, protect the environment, and not perpetuate overconsumption, they placed a full-page ad in the New York Times saying, "Don't buy this jacket," on Black Friday. Patagonia demonstrates again and again its commitment to its values. So much so that the company has even said they are not looking to grow, an idea that is anathema to capitalism and marketing. Connecting social responsibility to the bottom line has created a brand that evokes commitment and passion on the part of its consumers. Socially responsible brands like this hold significant appeal for millennials, which is why more companies look to embed these values into their brands. In addition to Patagonia, we could include Tom's Shoes, Warby Parker Eyewear, and Interface Carpet. Unlike Lululemon, these companies demonstrate a commitment to the values they espouse, and through these practices come closest to the ideal of brand co-creation that was envisioned in the early days of participatory marketing. Most examples in this book fall in the area of company-facilitated brand evangelism. Are Red Bull users big fans of the product? Clearly. If you think that's because the drink tastes good, you probably haven't tried it. Megafans exist because the company is skilled at creating stories and events that their consumer wants to be connected with, music, extreme sports, technology, and share. In fact, Red Bull is now considered a media company almost more than it is an energy drink producer. Finally, let's not forget Starbucks. The brand has been incredibly successful in building a following of loyal customers. Some of that loyalty is related to their products, which people genuinely like. But coffee alone did not make people pushers of this caffeine purveyor. A series of marketing tools also led to Starbucks' reputation. For example, like Lululemon, Starbucks has a site where people can offer ideas, mystarbucksidea.force.com, and visitors are asked to share, vote, discuss, see, all key terms of co-creation. Starbucks was also early to develop a mobile app that is both useful and that keeps consumers connected to the brand. Customers can order ahead with the app to avoid in-store lines, as well as pay for their coffee and even digitally tip the barista. And, like Frito-Lay, the company asks for consumer input when picking new products, such as the newest flavor for their Frappuccino. All the goodwill generated by these marketing activities makes the hashtag Race Together debacle a blip on the map. Staying conscious of the role we have been given within this stealth framework is key to understanding the power relationships that marketers have prescribed. While the marketer's come-on is to say that they want a relationship, co-creation, the makeup of that interaction is more like one of boss to employee. We perform the labor of sharing, and we do it for free to boot. When we do speak up with complaints, they're either quickly squelched by a conscientious listener from the company who placates us, or we complain about something trivial, like a misguided marketing campaign. Rather than the consumer empowerment of the early 2000s, which involved some vague level of brand hijacking, what exists today is a more tightly controlled communication environment. The goal has been to move consumers away from brand hijack toward brand evangelism, and by and large, that movement has been successfully executed. And while marketers talk about co-creation, it is hard to say that it is what occurs in the real world, because corporations set the guidelines within which the conversation about their brand takes place. We saw that with the Super Bowl ads and with the T-Mobile Facebook app, and there are many more examples. Everyone can submit videos to GoPro, but not every video is posted. Everyone can submit a new Lay's flavor, but Frito-Lay decides the winner, while simultaneously generating thousands of flavor suggestions voted on by millions of people without having to pay for research and development or the accompanying free publicity. Socially conscious brands come close to co-creation, but those companies are a limited few. Evangelism equals sharing, and just like religious institutions, marketers want to keep a very tight rein on the message that gets dispersed. According to the marketing firm Edelman, 66% of consumers feel that interactions with corporations are tilted in favor of the brands, and 70% feel that brands are motivated by a self-centered desire to increase profits rather than by a sincere commitment to their customers. But still, we do their bidding. The problem is not that we're unaware that corporations control the message. It's that when we're online, we don't behave as if we know it. Corporations grabbed back the megaphone, and they are using it to loudly proclaim our empowerment, even though nothing could be farther from the truth. If you want real consumer empowerment, there's one simple thing you can do. Stop sharing content.